This podcast is an initiative of the Australian Intercollegiate Meat Judging Association to showcase the career paths available within the meat processing industry. ICMJ is a not-for-profit organisation which aims to provide opportunities for students to learn, building the pool of intelligent young meat industry representatives into the future. ICMJ does this through a series of events across Australia and overseas. For more information, head to the website icmj.com.au. Professor Dave Pethick's career has taken him around the world and back again. A committed biochemist, researcher and mentor, Dave has been working in the field of meat science for 40 years. I'm Amy McCosker and I started my conversation with Dave by asking him if growing up on a sheep property in the Adelaide Hills inspired his career choice.
Oh, I think hugely. I mean, we ran a Board Leicester stud, which is a maternal sheep breed. I think at that peak we had about 450 ewes, which were fully, you know, recorded. And it was very intensive work. You were ear tagging lambs at birth and mothering up to get full pedigree. And of course, my mother she kept these full records on all 450 ewes. We just had volumes and volumes. So each ewe had two pages about her. The idea of recording, closely observing, and interpreting was ingrained into me from about the age of, probably 6 or 5 years old. It was incredible what my mother and father did and the records they kept. And the genetic progress they made just by recording. We were not able to measure weights and things like that, but because we knew, you know, which ewes had twins or which rams were a twin themselves, we started selecting rams from ewes that had twins over multiple years and that their mothers also had twins before them over multiple years. So you had these sort of like maternal lines. So it really created a very strong maternal outcome, particularly for our stud at the time, before mum and dad retired and my brother changed direction. So so did I, of course. So that was a wonderful start to, the importance of data recording, observation and attention to detail was what that was all about.
So you ended up leaving the farm. What was your first step out into the world?
Yeah, well, I guess mum and dad were quite keen for me to go to university if I could manage it, which luckily I did. And, of course, I did do agricultural science. So although I left the farm, my heart was strongly in ag science. But I got sucked in by the first 2 years were probably pretty much pure science, you know, anatomy and, botany and zoology and maths and chemistry. But I just got sucked in by the knowledge and the depth of understanding. And then once I started getting into biochemistry, you know, it's sort of, yeah, biochemistry is a wonderful thing. It's sort of like there's no racism in biochemistry. Once you get down to the cellular level, there's massive commonality across all sorts of animals and people and stuff like that. So it just brought everything together for me. And I was just a sucker. I just got into it and were very fortunate. I had really good teachers and good mentors. And then the last 3 years were very much agricultural focused, but pretty theoretical though. Even still, we didn't learn to fix tractors. You know, we learned how cells work. It was a classic joke. I'd always go home, you know, back to the farm in the holidays, earn a bit of money, carting hay for the next door neighbour and stuff. And it didn't matter what it was. You know, the tractor was broken. I'd go, oh, you'll know how to fix this, won't you? You've been to university. They used to get really stuck into me.
Now, I know that after finishing at Adelaide Uni, you then made the decision to continue overseas and not at any uni. You went to Cambridge. So what was that like? What was that experience like for you?
Oh, that was an incredible experience. I was very lucky to get a scholarship it was before the days of full fee students. So, you know, the scholarship was quite viable it was a wonderful place. I worked at an agricultural research institute, so it was allied to Cambridge University. So I used to ride my bike about 6 kilometres out of town every day to this institute, which was a very famous one. It was pretty. It was pretty classical. Like I remember when I first arrived, they had these people called porters. The head porter, he's like the policeman of the college. They wear suits and bowler hats, but they're good, lovely, old-fashioned working-class people. And this fellow had a really grumpy voice, probably heavy smoker or something, I can't remember. And he said, welcome, Mr. Pevitt, after travelling umpteen hours from Australia. I said, the name's Dave, mate. He said, welcome, Mr. Pevitt. Anyway, after 3 years of running functions, and you always had to keep Jaggard, that's the head porter, on board, of course, because he'd be snooping around making sure that people weren't getting up to no good. And after 3 years as my departing party, he came up to me and said, well, well done, David, you've done a marvellous job. So it took him 3 years to call me by my first name, and apparently that was the ultimate... accolade from that fella. But just goes to show you how, in many ways, how old-fashioned and it was. But it was still a wonderful experience, yeah.
What did your fellow students and teachers make of you? I mean, a farmer's son from Australia, was there much awareness of agriculture abroad at that time, in your opinion?
Oh, I think they thought we were a mob of Philistines, you know, and I probably lived up to that to some extent, but... they soon realised the beauty of the Australian demeanour. We're largely not influenced by position in society, if you understand. Whereas in the UK, position in society is upper class, lower class, you know, that sort of stuff is still somewhat entrenched. So the ability of an Aussie, and I'm no different to all my friends and all the young kids around now, is that we just rock up and say, "G'day, mate, how are you going?" And ironically, they loved it. You know, so I remember Prince Philip rocked up. He was the Chancellor of our college. And we were talking about a disease in the horses. It was a rather nasty venereal disease that was broken out in Newmarket near Cambridge, a very famous horse here in the UK. And anyway, they'd named it the kangaroo clap because it was a venereal disease that had suspicions of coming from Australia. So we got stuck into Prince Philip on this. But, you know, the fact that we could just go out and talk to him, and he loved it, of course. He loved just a discussion about animals and biology and diseases and things. So I think just that ability to be open and just walk up and say, "G'day, mate."
And after studying at such a level, what made you want to come back home?
Oh, I always had a deep desire to come back home. I wrote to my mother and father about every 2 weeks with an aerogram, and Mum kept them all. And I look back at them not after she passed away. Mum passed away last and a few years back, and I had this deep desire to still contribute to the farm and to Australian agriculture. So. I mean, jobs were difficult to get at the time. You know, job vacancies in universities, which is what I was after, are fairly variable because, you know, people live quite a long time in one job before they go. You've got to wait for them to almost retire. But I was very keen to come back. But, you know, I guess if a job hadn't occurred, I guess I could well have stayed there. And that would have been, my life would have been very different if I did. But I just had a deep desire to come back and contribute to Australian agriculture and animal science.
So when the time came and you did come home, what was the first thing you sort of put your mind to, or the first thing you tackled?
Well, the first thing I tackled was really completing some of the stuff I'd done in the thesis. So it was more quite theoretical work on muscle and fat metabolism and the adaptations that sheep and cattle have that are different to the laboratory rat. And you might say, well, why would I be comparing to the laboratory rat? But the laboratory rat was virtually everybody did all their biochemistry on the rat, because you could just buy rats, you know, you could buy white rat, brown rats or whatever, and you could, excuse the term, but you could grind them up and measure their muscles and relatively easily. But I just never really connected with rats, to be perfectly frank. And, continued on my work understanding the volatile fatty acid contributions to energy metabolism in the liver and the gut and the muscle. Quite theoretical stuff, but stuff I'm still very proud of.
You didn't write your first paper about meat science until, I think, about 1996, which was 16 years into your career. If you could cast your mind back to that time, what was the baseline of meat science when you first started working in this field?
Oh, well, we were just starting to see the complexities of and carcass grading and Meat Standards Australia. It was just a bit before that. But before, I used to think meat science was a bit drab. It was very much instrumental measurement, a lot of tenderness measurements using an instrumental machine. Even taste panels were calibrated to this instrumental machine, which seemed sort of weird in hindsight. And a lot of it was on sausages and, you know, salami, all quite important things. But it just, for some reason, and because I was never taught it in my degree in the old days, we didn't do meat science in Australia back in those days. It never really tickled my fancy until I got the opportunities and the light bulb moments came on.
What have you seen change since then? I'm guessing things like HGPs were, or might have been a pretty hot topic back in the 90s.
I think growth promotants probably, I mean, are still used. It's not so much a change, it's more of an understanding of them. I mean, growth promotants were actually fully discovered and commercialised back in my PhD days in the late 1970s. So they're a fairly mature technology. But the real thing that was the big change that really switched me on was the true focus on the consumer. So whatever we do with respect to cattle or lambs, we have to think about the consumer. So, you know, consumers don't buy cattle. Consumers don't buy buy carcasses. You know, consumers don't even buy cuts. They buy meal solutions, to be honest, but I guess cuts getting closer to it. So that was where the break of, you know, having the privilege to join Rod Polkinghorne and the Meat Standards Australia team to really hammer out a consumer-focused approach to meat science, which was, you know, it was a total game changer. Because before, it was about getting carcasses looking all the same or something like that, or having the most perfect carcass. But, you know, the most perfect carcass is not what it's about. It's about the meal solution that you get off those carcasses. So, that was the huge shift. And, of course, underneath all that, there's a whole lot of biology. And that's where I guess I flourished initially, although I soon understood and connected even more with the industry through that process, because not only did we develop MSA as a team, but we had to try and implement it as a team, which was not easy, I can assure you, in the early period.
You must feel a lot of pride when you look at the MSA program and see where it is today.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, it's a bit like a CRC. I mean, bless the forefathers, John Webster and others at Meat and Livestock Australia, who have stuck with that scheme for about 20-odd years now. We had our 20th anniversary, I think it was last year, we got together and celebrated, and you know, it's a long, consistent program of focus on the consumer, and you know, if we just funded it for 3 years, it would have fallen over. It needed that longer period of underpinning to get there, because we were, you know, changing the whole landscape, telling people that the Bosindica's cattle were tougher. On average, you know, it was, you know, and the Bosindicus is a beautiful breed of cattle and very important up your way in those more tropical areas. So once we did enough work to find that out, then we have to work out, well, how the hell can we alleviate some of these things? So, of course, we found that there's some very influential genes which can fix it largely, and that'll even get better with genomics. But then, of course, then there's mitigation strategies like, you know, tender stretch and aging and putting a bit more marbling in the animals and things like that. So you come up with the problem, industry panics a little bit early on, but then we all sit down and go, well, hang on, let's try and work this out, and of course, which you can. So it's now a far more collegiate approach to carcass grading and where we're heading.
I would imagine that in those early days, things might have been a bit less collegial, like when it was said that some breeds carry better traits than others, and that sort of information was new to people. It must have been pretty pretty controversial sort of topic back in those days.
Oh, of course, yeah. Oh, it was outrage, and even the when we started working on the hormonal growth promotants. So it was very challenging for us to be telling people that HGPs make meat tough, or tougher, should I say. And of course, I think they thought we were trying to ban HGPs. Now, we had no political allegiance either way. That was a supply chain decision, as far as we were concerned. If you want the efficiencies of growth through hormones, of course, use them. But if you want to optimise meat quality for a different sort of market, well, maybe don't. But that's, we just simply wanted the facts to be out there. But we got, oh, we got attacked initially by some of the companies in a very aggressive manner. But anyway, we held strong. We even managed to find, I think it was something like 25 different publications worldwide, and did what's called a meta-analysis on that. And those 25 papers unilaterally supported our work. So we got there in the end. And now HGPs, it's not so much a political ball anymore. You can use them or not use them depending on your supply chain. Simple as that. No more politics involved. And they're still used quite heavily and quite useful. No problem.
So back up to 2020 now. What's being done right now in terms of research to bring the MSA program even further?
Oh, well, we're still working on aspects of MSA in lamb and beef, particularly still around glycogen or muscle sugar, which you need a certain amount of glycogen or muscle sugar at slaughter to stop dark cutting and high pH meat in both lamb and beef. So we're still working on that. It's it's becoming harder. You know, all the simple questions have almost left us, and we're still working on farm about how to get glycogen levels to be elevated or maintained on farm. We initially went in with the hypothesis way back that, of course, all the trouble was at the abattoir, because if cattle are run around or badly handled, the stress will deplete that muscle sugar. But, you know, ironically, nearly all our work, once we started doing muscle biopsies on farm with the little drills and all sorts of things like that, we found that most of the troubles emanate actually on farm, and that the abattoirs are almost unilaterally doing a good job unless something, you know, unforeseen happens. So yeah, it's quite complex. Some great work with other staff and postgrads, Pete McGilchrist, head of ICMJ on King Island, you know, looking at perennial pastures that look really good, but there's mineral imbalances, magnesium is low. Endophytes in pastures, you know, the endophytes are like fungal components in pastures that change the behaviour of cattle and sheep and affect their muscle chemistry. So it's just a gorgeous route to keep discovering how to optimise something like glycogen in muscle, which should be, you know, dead easy. So that's one of our recent works. And we still work on marbling. I mean, I think all the work I've done on marbling, I'm a bit embarrassed, really. It's some of the most highly cited work that I've done. But it's just really dismantled the myths around marbling, because marbling has so many myths, you know, those Japanese black cattle in Japan that get fed beer and massaged and everything else, that must improve it and da-di-da-di-da. In fact, it's just simply fat cells inside muscle that grow. And they grow like any other fat tissue. It's, you know, it's more the genetic propensity that they actually occur in muscle, because fat distribution is a very genetic thing. Like Kalahari Bushmen, excuse my language, have got really fat bottoms. And whereas, you know, I've got a fat tummy. So that is like genetic predispositions as to where you lay down fat and don't lay down fat. And of course, marbling cattle and sheep that can marble, they can lay down some of that fat actually inside muscle. So and I guess the other stuff we're working on now is more the practical carcass grading and trying to get instrumental grading happening, which is pretty important in sheep, important in cattle, but of course we can grade cattle pretty well now with human graders. But of course, sheep run past you at an abattoir at something like 10 to 12 a minute, and we don't break sheep at a quartering site until right at boning. So carcass grading in sheep is far more challenging. So we've got a lot of work to do on technology there to try and improve and implement carcass grading in sheep.
And with all of that research happening now and in the future, you must be just shouting out for more researchers to come on board.
Well, it's true. We are. We've always usually got a, somewhere between between postdoctoral students, between technical staff, and PhD students or honours students. We've probably always got about 20 people needed to keep the machine going. So that's at every level, whether the student's finished and wants to be a technical officer or whether the student wants to go further, etc. So, yeah, once the machine is put in motion, it's it needs a lot of people to keep it going, because it's often labour intensive, going to farms, going to abattoirs, a lot of laboratory work which still requires manual preparation. So, yeah, there's plenty of activity and a great place for students to begin and start their meat science career for sure.
And with that said, how do you attract students to consider meat science? Do you have a bit of an elevator pitch for when you speak to science students to sort of draw them over to your side?
Yeah, well, the first thing I say to them is, like, if you're going to be into sheep and cattle, you know, at any level, some knowledge of meat science is crucial, and it's going to contribute to your career, even if you don't end up with me or working at an abattoir, you know, where it's hardcore meat science, if you know what I mean. So that's something that's really changed in the modern world. You know, most veterinarians, most animal science kids, if they're going to be working with a feedlot, or let alone an abattoir, or working with a genetics consortium, we're looking at welfare research. A knowledge of meat science is going to improve their ability, one, to get employed, and two, understand what's going on, and three, make a contribution enormously, because it's a key cog in the whole wheel. And you know, the great thing about meat science is you can apply it everywhere, literally from this farm to fork or paddock to plate. You know, so as I was talking about glycogen and pastures, if you want to understand your pastures, well, you can put a meat science context on it. Whoever would have thought that we'd be measuring endophytes or fungi in blinking grass, but in relation to meat quality, we'd never been heard of 10 years ago. So that diversity is something that I cherish and love about meat science. I mean, the other thing about meat science, if you want to become even more specialist in it, it's a big business. So that, you know, there are real opportunities, whether they be opportunities at a university, which are probably trivial in terms of numbers, but significant when you add the technical staff and the other students. But you've got many many abattoirs around the country. The big supermarkets, they run terrific development programs, if you like. I know that many kids with an agricultural and meat science background don't normally think of that. Why would I go to Coles or Woolies? I'm only just using those two supermarkets because they are two big ones. But you've got IGA and Aldi and others as well. But of course, you know, working with big supermarkets, you get in the meat department, of course, it's a whole new world. You still have to understand on-farm factors because they still buy sheep and cattle. They slaughter them, usually under some agreement with an abattoir, but that still needs management. And then, of course, you've got all the stuff at the case-ready end. So it's just explaining that it's a big business and there are many opportunities for employment that where a meat science twist probably best combined with a good solid knowledge of agriculture. I think the two, hopefully, we would all agree, just go hand in hand, is a huge start. Also, of course, you've got the allied companies that support agriculture. Different agricultural companies that help sell livestock and supply materials. There's drug companies. Anybody without a meat science slant is going to be a lesser person in those positions.
So thinking back to your parents breeding sheep in the 1950s, what do you think they'd make of this new world of meat science we find ourselves in, you know, now in 2020?
I guess so. I mean, Mum and Dad would love this genomics area, and I think that's an important area for the future, because I really have meat science and genetics are intrinsically linked, and so some of the strongest scientific connections I would have these days would actually be with the geneticists. They're very talented people. They're really smart, really good with data, you know, so I just enjoy them full stop. But I think, you know, some of the new areas of where we're heading, and genomics has got to be a key because, you know, it's going to be multifaceted. We're going to need deep phenotyping, deep further measures of meat, always linked to the consumer outcome, of course, to find out what is beyond marbling, you know, what's the next thing for marbling? Because marbling is the major genetic factor at the moment for improving meat. I mean, growth rate does it a bit because, you know, you can turn them off younger and earlier. But there's got to be a lot of factors in the chemical makeup of muscle that we've not really discovered. And I think modern genomics with deep phenotyping, by deep phenotyping, I'm talking about, you know, shoving meat through a mass spectrometer and getting millions of answers out of it. And then smarter people than me seeing whether we can find patterns that relate to quality consumer outcomes. So, yeah, it's an exciting area, and that's going to be bigger than Ben-Hur, I'm sure.
And you beat me to the punch there, Dave, because my final question for you was, where do you want to see meat science go in the next 30 years?
Yeah, well, I think that's one of them, but, you know, I think this, hopefully no one ever forgets the consumer and just keeping always coming back to the consumer. I think this international collaboration is important and something big for the future, because I believe that it's certainly something I believe, that if MSA is more widely understood internationally, it's got to be one to the consumer's advantage everywhere. So if everybody's getting better beef, people eat beef, people pay more for beef, everybody's better off, yeah? You know what I mean? Whereas, and so I think the international focus is really good. You know, we've got to continually get the myths out of industry. They're still there, you know, days on feed. What does that mean? Hey, just grade the carcass, mate. That'll tell you. Like, what is Janine Lau, one of our top graders in the country? She says, Dave, carcasses never lie. I love that. I love that that term. You know, get, you know, dentition. We still have dentition, of course, which we know has almost no relationship with eating quality. So there's a lot of myths to work on, and so that's sort of like the extension side of things, I guess. You've really got to work hard at that, and it's slow and hard, but you do go forward. I think technology and carcass grading, that's important. I've already mentioned that, and particularly where you can't do it in a species like lamb, but there'll be good grading opportunities, I'm sure, in beef as we explore the exciting opportunities of some of these high throughput X-ray systems that they use in, you know, baggage handling and airports and things like that. These things are pretty fancy machines. So there's some exciting opportunities there. You know, maybe we can get at last some you know, better imaging of live animals. That's a real challenge as well, to if we could get better estimates of meat quality in the live animal, again connected to genomics. It's a dream of mine that MSA becomes more international. I think that'd be a really important benchmark. That'd just make it go to the next level. I mean, the next benchmark is to use MSA to its fullest. MSA can be used as a crude in-out system, and it works well like that. But to harness MSA and get the most value out of a carcass and the most value for the consumer, we really need, you know, more sophisticated cut-based grading. We have it, we can do it, but it's not easy to do in an abattoir, so there'll be some technology additions required to do that. But, to get that full carcass utilisation at its maximum price, I think will be important because, you know, for the future, it's going to be hard to think that beef and lamb can be produced more cheaply. I doubt whether it can be. Sure, we'll always select for faster growing animals. We'll try and find better grass swards, better grain feeding techniques, etc. But we're going to be an expensive product, red meat. And so if we're an expensive product, you know, we really must get the most utilization as we can out of the carcasses. Yeah, that'll be important.
This podcast is an initiative of the Australian Intercollegiate Meat Judging Association to showcase the career paths available within the meat processing industry. For more information, head to the website icmj.com.au.